Well, it is time for us to wish our listeners who are celebrating a birthday today on this May 8th a very happy birthday. We have four listeners we have in our list. Harold Dennis from Oskaloosa, Shirley LaFollette from Boone, Steve Turner from Glenwood, and Phyllis Judge from Bettendorf. All of us here at IRIS would like to wish the four of you a very happy birthday. And this is a reminder, you're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. If you're hearing us on your television on Iowa PBS and you're not a registered IRIS user, please give us a call at 515-243-6833 so that we can get you on our list. We need to know who is listening in order to keep our services free. And now here's Barb with today's obituaries.
Thank you, Dennis. Giovanni E. Serena, age 93, of West Des Moines, passed away on Sunday, May 5th. Giovanni was born on May 12, 1930, in Cavasso Nuovo, Italy, to Domenico and Elsa Serena. Giovanni married the love of his life, Louise Lovisa, on January 29, 1955. They met on the dance floor and continued dancing their way through life, holding hands and cherishing each other. Together, they decided to emigrate to the United States from Italy, sailing to New York City in May of 1958 and settling in New Orleans before moving to West Des Moines in 1969. They loved spending time with their family, traveling, and cooking together. To provide for his family, Giovanni was a tile installer who began his career in Italy, working across Europe and Africa, before settling in the United States. He was also considered a jack of all trades. He enjoyed taking things apart and fixing them. Even if they didn't need to be fixed, he did it in his way. His hobbies included stained glass, painting beautiful landscapes, and making mosaics. Giovanni loved to garden and placed as many homemade bird wind catchers in his flower bed. He loved spending time with his grandchildren and later his great-grandchildren. A specialty of his was homemade grappa. Later in life, he found his home at Cedar Ridge Village, and he really enjoyed the time he spent there. Giovanni is survived by his children, Lorenzo and Gianna, four grandchildren, five great-grandchildren. Also, his brother, Dominic Serena. He was preceded in death by his parents, four brothers, and one sister. A mass of Christian burial will be held at 11 a.m. on Friday, May 10th, at Sacred Heart Catholic Church in West Des Moines. Visitation will be from 5 to 7 p.m. on Thursday evening at McLaren's Funeral Chapel, with a rosary at 7 p.m. A private family entombment will be at Rest Haven Mausoleum. In lieu of flowers, memorial contributions may be made to Unity Point Hospice. Leon Koppels, Sr., age 84, passed away on May 3rd after a courageous battle with lung and bone cancer. Born on June 24, 1939, he brought immense joy to those around him. Leon's journey touched the lives of many, leaving behind cherished memories and a legacy of strength and resilience. His unwavering spirit in the face of adversity was an inspiration to all who knew him. Leon graduated from North High School in 1958. In 1960, he had met Margaret Mullen, who he would marry on May 6, 1962, and spent a beautiful 56 years together until her passing in 2018. Leon was a veteran, a firefighter, and a union man. Leon worked for Colonial Bakery and then Armstrong Tire and Rubber until retirement. He loved to keep busy and volunteer where possible by helping start the Waukee Girls Youth Softball League, volunteered for the Waukee Fire Department, and was a member of the Lions Club. He was an avid vehicle enthusiast, usually trading in vehicles every year or two. Leon is survived by his children, Jody Downing of Pella and Leon Koppel of Sioux City, four grandchildren, Cameron Downing, Carson Downing, Ashton Patton, and Gabriel Patton, his great-grandchildren, Eva and Oliver, many nieces, nephews, his quote-unquote daughter, Tynetta Rashid, and close friend, Pam McMahon. He was preceded in death by his beloved wife, Margaret, his parents, John and Ethel Koppel, and his sister, Donna Sampson. Please join in remembering and celebrating Leon's life. Visitation will be held from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m., with a funeral service beginning at 10 a.m. on Friday, May 10th, at Hamilton's near Highland Memory Gardens at 121 Northwest 60th Avenue, with a burial to follow at Highland Memory Gardens Cemetery. Flowers and condolences may be sent to Hamilton's near Highland Memory Gardens. Online condolences may be expressed at hamiltonsfuneralhome.com. May Leon rest in eternal peace, free from pain, and may his memory continue to bring comfort to those who mourn his passing. Martin J., known as Hap Feinstead, Jr., died May 4th at Wesleyan Grand in Des Moines. A funeral service is scheduled for Thursday, May 9th at 11 a.m. at West Des Moines Christian Church. Visitation will begin at 10 a.m. at the church, with lunch served immediately following the service, and burial in Woodward Cemetery at 2 p.m. Hap earned his nickname in junior high, and he carried his generally happy outlook throughout all of his 102 years. Hap was born to Martin and Hazel Feinstead, Sr. in Granger on April 15, 1922, the fourth of five children. He graduated from Granger High School in 1939. Hap married Virginia Harker of Woodward on December 20, 1941. They were the parents of one son, Tom Feinstead. Following graduation, he farmed with his dad until he started farming on his own at age 22. After 20 years, Hap retired from farming and purchased a grocery store in Granger called Hap's AG, which Hap and Virginia operated for 10 years before retiring. After a short retirement period, they decided to go back to work. Hap's final 10-year employment venture was as an electrician at Camp Dodge, retiring for a final time in 1984. In addition to paying positions, Hap was a woodworker and jack-of-all-trades. He was a chief jigsaw operator for all of the craft items made by the ladies of the Granger Christian Church, and no repair job was too large or too small for him. All you had to do was ask. Hap spent most of his life in the Granger area, less than 2 miles from the home where he was born. His wife Virginia died in 1996. In 2000, at age 87, Hap married Juanita Russell Kincaid and moved to Urbandale for 19 years, then the Lodge of Ashworth in West Des Moines for 5 years, before moving to Wesleyan Grand in Des Moines. Hap is survived by his wife Juanita, son Tom Feinstead of Henderson, Nevada, granddaughter Natasha Feinstead of Scottsdale, Arizona, grandson Nathan Feinstead of West Des Moines, step-granddaughter Mindy Shepherd of Des Moines, great-grandson Preston Otto of Scottsdale, and sister Betty Strutz of Great Falls, Montana. Also surviving are his stepchildren Bruce Kincaid of Bartlesville, Oklahoma, step-daughter-in-law Kathy Kincaid Young of Minnetonka, Minnesota, stepdaughters Diane Fox of Des Moines, and Dana Kincaid of Long Beach, California, 13 step-grandchildren and 8 step-great-grandchildren. He was preceded in death by his parents, his first wife Virginia, brother Lowell, and sisters Gladys Roth and Georgia Wilson, step-grandson Chad Decker, and stepson Scott Kincaid. Memorials may be made to the West Des Moines Christian Church, Wesleyan Grand Good Samaritan Fund, or Wesleyan Grand Hospice. Online condolences are welcome at islescares.com. And Donald Winter, 93, of Fontenelle, passed away on Saturday, May 4th, at the Perry Lutheran Home in Perry, Iowa. Celebration of Life services will be held on Saturday, May 11th, at 11 a.m. at the Lamb Funeral Home in Fontenelle, with burial in the Fontenelle Cemetery. Full military graveside rites will be conducted by the Fontenelle American Legion Carlson Post number 247. A luncheon will be held at the Lamb Funeral Home in Fontenelle following the burial. The Lamb Funeral Home in Fontenelle is in charge of the professional arrangements. Online condolences may be left to the family at lambfuneralhomes.com. Open visitation will be held at the Lamb Funeral Home on Friday, May 10th from 2 to 6 p.m. Family visitation will be held at the Lamb Funeral Home on Saturday, May 11th from 10 to 11 a.m. Memorials may be made to the Donald Winter Memorial Fund to be established by the family at a later date. He is survived by his stepdaughter, Carmen Buell, and husband Larry of Urbandale, 2 granddaughters, 3 nieces, and nephew, and Let's see, three nieces, Sandra Wiley, Cynthia Sickles, and husband David, and Charlene Murphy, nephew Earl Winter, and wife Eddie, and many other relatives and friends.
That concludes the obituaries. Thank you, Barb, for those. Moving on to some more national news from New York. Stormy Daniels takes the stand in trial. Defense demands mistrial, claiming testimony unduly prejudicial. On the 13th day of the first-ever criminal prosecution of a former president, after all the jury testimony about ledgers and bookkeeping, Stormy Daniels got to the heart of the incident Donald Trump allegedly wanted to hush up, an encounter in his hotel suite. It was a tawdry account of gold tweezers and silky pajamas, punctuated by a defense demand for a mistrial that the judge rejected. Trump is charged with 34 counts of falsifying business records for allegedly trying to hide a $130,000 hush money payment to Daniels through his lawyer, Michael Cohen. Trump denies having had sex with the adult film actor and has pleaded not guilty. With Trump's son Eric looking on, Daniels unspooled a salacious and unflattering tale. Daniels said she was 27 years old when she met the reality TV star, then 60, at a celebrity golf tournament in Lake Tahoe in July of 2006. At the tournament dinner, a Trump bodyguard named Keith approached Daniels, inviting her to meet the real estate mogul for dinner. Daniels went up to Trump's hotel suite for the meeting. Trump greeted Daniels wearing silky pajamas. She made a joke asking if Hugh Hefner knew that Trump was wearing his clothes. She told Trump to go change, and he obliged, she said, putting on a dress shirt and dress pants. They made getting to know you chit-chat, she said. Trump asked if she had a boyfriend. She didn't. He asked business questions about the adult film industry. Were there unions? Was there testing for sexually transmitted diseases? How did she get paid? He asked if she ever had tested positive for an STD. No, never, she told him. She commented on a photo of Melania Trump that was in the suite. She's very beautiful. What about your wife? Trump told Daniels not to worry about that, that he and his wife didn't sleep in the same room, Daniels testified. The light conversation continued. Trump, famously proud of his hair, told Daniels about a contest in which the loser would have to shave his head. You do not have the head designed to be without hair, she responded. He agreed and said all that stuff was predetermined and he knew it wouldn't happen to him. Daniels said she grew annoyed by Trump's frequent interruptions and asked him, quote, are you always this arrogant and pompous? He dared her to spank him with a magazine, and she did. That's bullcrap, Trump appeared as he watched from the defendant's table. He was much more polite after that, Daniel said. They discussed his golf course in Scotland and traveling, she said. Trump said he might be able to get her on The Apprentice. At this point, Judge Juan Merchan told the prosecution to limit the detail. Daniels used the restroom, noticing Old Spice and gold tweezers. When she came out, Trump was on the bed posing in his underwear, she described. She said she thought, oh my God, and asked herself what she had misread. She laughed nervously, she said, and at first tried to make a joke and step around to leave. She said she didn't feel physically threatened, although she knew there was a power imbalance and a bodyguard right outside. Daniel said she blacked out despite consuming no drugs or alcohol and woke up on the bed naked. She did not tell Trump to stop. I didn't say anything at all, she said. I was trying to think about anything other than what was happening there. She made a reference to their sexual position and the defense objected, which the judge sustained. Asked by the prosecution whether Trump wore a condom, Daniels said no. As Daniels was ready to leave the suite, Trump said they were fantastic together and that she should be gotten onto his show. Daniels said she later met Trump on another occasion and discussed The Apprentice. At one point, he made passes and she declined, saying she had her period. Eventually, Daniels said Trump told her he couldn't get her on the show. She didn't talk to him again, she said. She decided to keep the incident private after being threatened in a parking lot in 2011, but changed her mind during Trump's 2016 presidential bid when he faced multiple accusations of sexual misbehavior, she testified. During the hush money negotiations, Daniels understood Cohen to be representing Trump. She said she cared some, but not much, about the dollar amount. 2 years later, the Wall Street Journal reported on the hush money payment and her life became chaos, Daniels said. After lunch, the defense demanded a mistrial, saying Daniels' testimony was unduly prejudicial. Aside from pure embarrassment, the only purpose of her comments was to inflame this jury to not look at the evidence that matters, lawyer Todd Blanche said. He was particularly furious that Daniels seemed to raise possibility that the encounter was non-consensual. Such testimony is impossible to come back from, Blanche said. Merchant declined to grant the mistrial. Some things Daniels said would have been better left unsaid, he said, but he noted that he sustained many of the defense's objections. I was surprised the defense didn't object more, the judge said. Then the defense dove into cross-examination, grilling Daniels on inconsistency in her story about the parking lot threat and generally questioning her motives. Quote, am I correct that you hate President Trump? Trump lawyer Susan Nicholas asked. Yes, Daniels said. You've been making money by claiming to have sex with the president, Trump, for more than a decade, right? Nicholas asked. Daniels responded that she's been making money by telling the story of what happened to her. Nicholas prodded again on the story, making Daniels a lot of money. Quote, it has also cost me a lot of money, Daniels said. She clarified that Trump did not force her into sex.
Majority of Americans predict Trump conviction. Guilty? Americans, by nearly 3-1, predict that former President Donald Trump will be convicted on all or some of the felony charges he faces in a New York courtroom, an outcome never before seen in U.S. history. In an exclusive USA Today Suffolk University poll, 65% of those surveyed say they expect a guilty verdict on at least some of the 34 charges that Trump tried to affect the 2016 election by paying hush money to a porn star, then falsifying business records to cover it up. Just 23% of those surveyed, disproportionately Trump supporters, say he will be exonerated. Never before has a former president faced criminal charges, and never before has a majority party's presumptive presidential nominee been prosecuted as Election Day loomed. Trump supporters are split over whether a conviction is coming. 44% predict a guilty verdict on at least some counts, 43% a not guilty verdict on all of them. Supporters of President Joe Biden, by an almost universal 86%, expect a conviction on at least some counts. The poll of 1,000 registered voters was taken by landline and cell phone on April 30th to May 3rd. It has a margin of error of plus or minus 3.1 percentage points. Overall, 15% expect Trump to be convicted on all 34 counts and 50% on some of them. Public opinion won't determine the trial's outcome, of course. That will depend on the 12 jurors who have been listening to testimony at Manhattan Criminal Court, with Trump sitting at the defendant's table. But the public's assessment will affect the repercussions afterward, including whether Americans accept the jury's judgment as just. Trump has railed against the trial, claiming without evidence that the charges were engineered by Biden and accusing Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg of political motives. His complaints have gotten traction. Overall, those surveys say by 44% to 39%, the trial isn't fair. Independents split 37% to 37% on the trial's fairness. Among men, white people, Hispanic voters, and seniors, more call the trial unfair than fair. That includes an overwhelming 85% of Trump supporters, but just 11% of Biden supporters. It's basically a sham, said Debbie Walta, 67, a Republican and Trump supporter from Helena, Montana. If they actually thought that they had a leg to stand on, they would have done this before he was trying to get reelected. Some others say unfairness is to Trump's benefits, not his peril. I think it's fair that he's being tried, said Kalima Muhammad, 57, of Tallahassee, Florida. She is a Democrat who supports Biden. but it's not fair to the extent that if there were a gag order on anybody else, and they violated it as often as he does, they would be in jail. Even those who expect a guilty verdict aren't sure how much effect it will have on the political campaign. Quote, it will only embolden his supporters even more because they will look upon it as a government taking advantage of Donald Trump, said Stephen Dombrowski, 76, a Democrat from Grand Island, New York. I don't think he can lose either way. And Putin starts a new six-year term with a challenge to the West. Russian President Vladimir Putin said it was up to the West to choose between confrontation and cooperation, as he was sworn in for a new six-year term on Tuesday at a Kremlin ceremony that was boycotted by the United States and many of its allies. More than 2 years into the war in Ukraine, Putin said he wanted to bow before Russia's soldiers there and declared in his inauguration speech that his landslide re-election in March was proof that the country was united and on the right track. Quote, you, citizens of Russia, have confirmed the correctness of this country's course. This is of great importance right now when we are faced with serious challenges, he told dignitaries in a gilded Kremlin hall where trumpet fanfares sounded to greet his arrival. I see in this a deep understanding of our common historical goals, a determination to adamantly defend our choice, our values, freedom, and the national interests of Russia, end quote. At 71, Putin dominates the domestic political landscape. Leading opposition figures are in prison or exile, and his best-known critic, Alexei Navalny, died suddenly in an Arctic penal colony in February. Yulia Navalnaya, the late dissident's wife, urged supporters in a video on Tuesday to keep up the struggle against Putin. With each of his terms, everything only gets worse, and it's frightening to imagine what else can happen while Putin remains in power, she said. On the international stage, Putin is locked in a confrontation with Western countries he accuses of using Ukraine as a vehicle to try to defeat and dismember Russia. Putin told Russia's political elite, after being sworn in, that he was not rejecting dialogue with the West, including on nuclear weapons. Quote, the choice is theirs. Do they intend to continue trying to restrain the development of Russia, continue the policy of aggression, insistent pressure on our country for years, or look for a path to cooperation and peace, he said. With Russia's troops advancing gradually in eastern Ukraine, the top U.S. intelligence officials said last week that Putin appeared to see domestic and international developments trending in his favor, and the conflict was unlikely to end anytime soon. It remains unclear how far Putin will seek to press the war and on what terms he might discuss ending it, decisions that will depend in part on whether Joe Biden or Donald Trump wins the U.S. presidential election in November. Ukraine says peace can only come with a full withdrawal of Russia's troops, who control nearly 20% of its territory. Putin, in power as president or prime minister since 1999, will surpass Soviet leader Joseph Stalin and become Russia's longest-serving ruler since 18th-century Empress Catherine the Great if he completes a new six-year term. He would then be eligible to seek re-election again. One of the decisions awaiting Putin in his new term will be whether to seek to renew or replace the last remaining treaty that limits Russian and U.S. strategic nuclear warheads. The New START agreement is due to expire in 2026.
From Amsterdam, Russia and Ukraine trade chemical use allegations. Global Watchdog says accusations insufficient. Russia and Ukraine have accused each other at the Global Chemical Weapons Watchdog in The Hague of using banned toxins on the battlefield, the organization said on Tuesday. The Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons said that the accusations were, quote, insufficiently unsubstantiated, but added, the situation remains volatile and extremely concerning regarding the possible re-emergence of use of toxic chemicals as weapons. Neither Russia nor Ukraine has formally asked the OPCW to investigate the alleged use of chemical weapons, it said. Last week, the U.S. said Russia had violated the international chemical weapons ban overseen by the OPCW by deploying the choking agent chloropicrin against Ukrainian troops and using riot control agents as a method of warfare in Ukraine. It followed Ukraine assertions in April that Russia had increased its use of tear gas in the trenches. Ukraine's general staff said in a statement earlier this month its armed forces had recorded 1,891 cases of Russia using ammunition equipped with dangerous chemical substances this year through April. Russia has denied allegations of violating the Chemical Weapons Convention. In documents posted on the OPCW website, Moscow accused Kyiv of using a wide range of toxic chemicals against Russian servicemen and public officials, including fertilizers, pesticides, and other banned toxins. Ukrainian officials on Tuesday did not immediately respond to a request for comment. The OPCW said it had been monitoring the situation since February of 2022 when Moscow invaded Ukraine. Under the Chemical Weapons Convention, any toxic chemical used with the purpose of causing harm or death is considered a chemical weapon. Ukraine says it caught agents for Russia plotting assassination. Ukraine's State Security Service said it caught two agents for Russia plotting the assassination of President Vladimir Zelensky and other top officials as a gift for Vladimir Putin as he was sworn in for a new term in the Kremlin on Tuesday. The two men were colonels in Ukraine's State Guard service recruited by Russia's Federal Security Service, who leaked classified information to Moscow, the Security Service of Ukraine, or SBU, said on the Telegram app. They were tasked with finding someone close to the presidential guard who could take Zelensky hostage and later kill him, the SBU statement said, without making clear at what point the alleged plot had been foiled. The terrorist attack, which was supposed to be a gift to Putin for the inauguration, was indeed a failure of the Russian special services, SBU chief Vasilis Malikok has quoted as saying, his agency on Telegram. There was no immediate comment from Moscow. The Kremlin declined to comment last month when asked about the arrest in Poland of a man accused of working with Russian intelligence to prepare a possible attempt to assassinate Zelensky. The Ukrainian leader said last autumn that his security services had foiled at least five Russian plots to assassinate him. The spy group also planned to eliminate Molik and Kirill Bundov, the military intelligence agency's head, the SBU said. And a little more state news from Nebraska. In Decatur, officials said a fire severely damaged the historic Decatur Museum, and most artifacts are likely destroyed, the Sioux City Journal reported. From Minnesota, Eden Prairie, a fire department is mourning after one of its own was killed in a shootout over the weekend, police said. Eden Prairie firefighter Joseph C. Johns died tragically while off duty on Sunday morning, the city of Eden Prairie said in a Facebook post. From Wisconsin, government spending on NINA infrastructure and equipment is projected to rise sharply next year. The city's newly approved capital improvement plan lists $105.6 million in expenditures in the next 4 years, including $42.7 million in 2025. And finally, from South Dakota, from Pierre, South Dakota Board of Regents has recently agreed to pay a former international student advisor at the University of South Dakota $100,000 to settle a lawsuit she brought alleging sexual harassment, sexual discrimination, and retaliation. And, well, for the last 90 minutes, your readers have been Barbara Heck and Dennis May, and it's been our pleasure to read for you. But now we're going to take a short break to allow our next readers to get into place.
Welcome back. Your new readers are Lisa Horsch and Patty Daniels. We'll continue with articles from the Des Moines Register and the USA Today, and here is Patty with our first opinion.
Colleges punish seniors over campus protests. Written for us by Sarah Piquino. For weeks now, students across the country have been protesting in support of Palestinians during the ongoing Israel-Hamas war. They have been met with police officers who have arrested more than 2,500 people nationwide and widespread criticism. Now, some colleges are going so far as to punish graduating seniors. On Monday, Columbia University in New York City announced that it will cancel its main graduation ceremony due to security concerns related to weeks of protests on its campus. It isn't the first school to make this decision. The University of Southern California canceled commencement in Los Angeles last month, and Emory University in Atlanta is changing the location of its ceremony. There will still be department ceremonies at Columbia and USC. Both will have celebrations for the graduates. That isn't the same as turning the tassel with hundreds of classmates. It's a shame that universities are so scared of protesters that they ruin the year for everyone. It's also an overreaction that is a different response from previous protests. Columbia still managed to have its 1968 spring graduation at a new location, despite anti-war and civil rights protests that mirrored the ones we see today. Kent State University even managed to hold a ceremony in 1970 after four anti-war college students were killed and nine injured by the Ohio National Guard. Perhaps the administrations of Columbia and USC aren't trying to emulate past decisions despite acting in ways that evoke memories of previous protests. Perhaps they were made nervous by protests at Indiana University and University of Michigan graduations. Either way, it seems unfair to the majority of students who did not participate in any wrongdoing. USC's decision feels particularly shameful. The administration initially canceled the valedictorian address from Asna Tabassum, an engineering student and Muslim American who was criticized for having a pro-Palestinian hyperlink in her social media bio. Columbia's decision to cancel graduation is the final say-so on a tumultuous semester, one that university leaders exacerbated by having a large police presence on campus even before Hamilton Hall was overtaken by protesters. It's not surprising that their decisions have continued to disappoint in the aftermath. Actions should have consequences, and I doubt that any of the students involved in the Hamilton Hall break-in would disagree. It makes sense that those students would face punishment from the university. It does not make sense for the entire 2024 class to lose out on college graduation. Meanwhile, Hamas leaders have said that they will accept a ceasefire proposal from Egypt and Qatar. This news came hours after Israeli announced plans to attack Rafah, the city in Gaza that has become a refuge for more than 1 million Palestinians since October 7th. A ceasefire would likely quell some of the angst we've seen on college campuses, but it won't change the events of the past few weeks. How university administrations have reacted to these protesters will follow them for years and create strained relationships with their alums. For students who have protested, this is all a formative experience. They should remember some victories, like the university's commitment to meeting with students to discuss divesting funds from Israel. Even that is a huge step forward, toward the collective goal shared by Gen Z protesters. I hope it doesn't destroy the spirit of these young people who want to see a world unlike the one we grew up in. And you can follow USA Today elections columnist Sarah Piquino on X, formerly Twitter. It's at Sarah Piquino, and Facebook, facebook.com pequeño rights.
Parents like me need the Kids Off Social Media Act. This is written by Nicole Russell for the USA Today. Parents worry about a lot of things, but one of our persistent concerns is our kids' smartphones. We justify their use by embracing their necessity. How else can we communicate about school pickups and sports practices? With that comes access to various minefields, from gaming to social media. As they go off to school and other activities, we wonder if they see things they shouldn't, talk to people they shouldn't, or rot their brains with excessive screen time. The remedies are obvious, just hard to implement. Don't get kids a phone. Ban social media, or allow social media with boundaries and parental controls. A new federal bill might help parents find a solution. We know now that excessive social media use increases depression and anxiety. A 2023 Surgeon General advisory found that 40% of children ages 8 to 12 are on social media. Social media and smartphone use have become so commonplace and ubiquitous that it truly does seem hard, if not impossible, to police, given everything parents have going on, including working a full-time job, maintaining relationships, and caring for themselves and their children. I have four children, and I'm constantly ruminating over the question, what is more important than my child's physical safety and emotional well-being? Three of my children have phones, so I've banned social media altogether. They also have limits on their screen time and can't keep their phones in their rooms overnight. I still check their phones regularly, but confess that constant surveillance has become an omnipresent task that provides endless questions and few solutions. There are ways to hide social media apps and bypass parental controls. Once kids become teenagers, they're not sitting in the living room 24/7 under parental supervision. They're often in school with friends, working a job, or on an athletic team, or maybe playing an instrument. They're busy, but still on their phones. Most parents know that social media use, especially multi-hour daily use, isn't great for their teen's emotional health, but they still feel ill-equipped to help their teen handle something as big as social media has become. Did you see that TikTok? Has to be one of the most common refrains in high school now. In fact, fitting in with their peers is probably the only upside to social media. If conformity is a plus, it's not. The downsides are worse than most parents realize. In January, Congress grilled the CEOs of Meta, TikTok, and others and revealed that sexual predators are rampant and other negative behaviors like bullying and eating disorders are magnified. Worse, all the executives knew this existed, and while they seemed to genuinely try to curb it, their own efforts fell short. This issue is so pressing that it spurred a Republican and a Democrat to co-sponsor legislation that would essentially ban social media for young children. If passed, the Kids Off Social Media Act would prevent kids younger than 13 from accessing social media, prohibit social media from programming algorithms for teens under 17, and give schools the ability to block access to social media. It's part of multiple attempts by lawmakers to place guardrails around the internet for children, including the Kids Online Safety Act. Senators Ted Cruz, Republican from Texas, and Brian Schatz, a Democrat from Hawaii, both dads, have paired up to unveil the Kids Off Social Media Act in the Senate Committee on Commerce, Science, and Transportation. Cruz told the Washington Post, "It's really hard to be a teenager today, and it is incredibly frightening to be a parent today. This legislation is trying to take a meaningful step to protect our kids." If passed, it's easy to see how parents everywhere, as well as school administrators and teachers, might sigh a breath of collective relief. However, it seems well within their purview to ban smartphones during class and block access to social media on district Wi-Fi, something that schools in Florida have already done and more are considering. The legislators say they haven't met a parent who doesn't support the bill because they feel pressure for their kids to be on social media. Cruz told me, "The reality of life is there's a moral a hazard, and no parent wants to be the one that forces his or her child to be excluded from the school social scene, to be ostracized from their friends. So I've had multiple conversations with moms and dads who are frustrated. They don't want their kids using these devices on these social media sites, but I think parents as a whole would much prefer that all the kids be protected. And this bill was designed to strike a compromise. Parental rights advocates on the left might argue that social media helps marginalize children or is their only outlet, even at a young age. Others on the right might balk at a bill that intervenes with their own role as a parent. It's also antithetical, some might say, for a Republican to sponsor a bill allowing a government bureaucracy to intervene in a child's daily habits. Social media companies don't like the bill either. They'll claim it's unconstitutional. Cruz, like many conservatives, has departed from the more libertarian live and let live stance. As a parent, I have yet to see how rampant social media use for kids under 13 is helpful or good for them. So I welcome a targeted and carefully crafted ban. It takes the issue out of parents' hands, just like laws about driving, alcohol consumption, or tattoos. The Federal Trade Commission's enforcement of the ban is tied to the bill, so the FTC couldn't deviate from the text, preventing a slippery slope of additional bans. Parenting is already challenging. Figuring out how to balance a tool that has become necessary and harmful makes it more so. Kids like mine wouldn't need an adjustment period, and if the bill passes and 11-year-olds become distraught because it's enforced, that might underscore its importance. Again, this was written by Nicole Russell. She is an opinion columnist with the USA Today, and she lives in Texas with her four kids.
We will go to sports now, and the sports on TV. All these times are Eastern. Wednesday, May 8th, hockey, National Hockey League, 7:30 p.m. ESPN, Boston at Florida. Basketball, National Basketball Association, 8 p.m. on TNT, Indiana at New York Knicks. Baseball, Major League Baseball, 1:05 p.m. MLBN, Toronto at Philadelphia. 1:10 p.m. MLBN, Detroit at Cleveland. 1:15 p.m. ESPN Plus New York Mets at, ESPN Plus New York Mets at St. Louis. 6:40 p.m. FS1 Arizona at Cincinnati. And 7:05 p.m. AMZP, I think that's Amazon Prime, Houston at New York Yankees.
In high school boys soccer, Roosevelt, a team to watch as postseason approaches. This is written by Ellie McCune. It's Monday night at Des Moines Roosevelt High School as rain and severe weather are blowing in from the west, but another storm is brewing on the soccer field between number 2 Des Moines Roosevelt in Class 3A and number 8 Des Moines Roosevelt in Class 4A. Both squads are in the midst of their best seasons in recent memory, with Hoover at 12-1 and Roosevelt at 9-3. In a matchup that is always contentious because two Des Moines schools, with Roosevelt holding a 6-5 record against Hoover since 2011 per GoBound.com, this one could be no different as the squads held for a 1-1 tie through 40 minutes of regulation and two 10-minute overtime periods. As whistles blew to mark the end of the second 10-minute overtime period, players dropped to the ground in exhaustion. Coaches took the field and trotted to their goalkeepers, looking to give them a pep talk or two penalty kicks to decide the winner. On the Rough Riders' side, Coach Matt Ream and junior captain goalkeeper Caden Lane appeared confident as Lane fended off sustained pressure and shots from Des Moines Hoover all game long. However, there was another issue aside from that. Midway through the second half, Lane dove to the ball looking to gather possession for his team as a Hoover player slid toward the ball in the box. With the studs of his cleats sticking out, the Hoover player accidentally struck Lane in the mouth with his cleats, cracking a molar tooth and cutting open Lane's face. Yet Lane remained undeterred, saving the two crucial penalty, penalty kicks to help Roosevelt clinch its 10th win of the season. The last time the Rough Riders did that was in 2018, so on the celebrations went on as the Rough Rider bench and fans stormed the field after the second wave and after senior Ethan Rodriguez clinched the game with his penalty kick. With his blood pumping following a high anxiety moment and a wild celebration, the pain started to settle in a bit for Lane. Lane joked, "The adrenaline's definitely keeping it up, and now I'm starting to feel it a little bit more." Monday night was a glimpse at how Roosevelt has gotten to this point, ranked inside the top 10 and beating one of the state's best for just the second time this season. Lane, while just a junior, earned captain status for moments like he had on Monday night. Despite being thrusted into the high-pressure moment and dealing with sustained pressure from Hoover all night, he was even keeled during and after the match, in spite of the cracked tooth. He spent much of the night directing his defense in front of him, shouting instructions and directing traffic as Hoover continued to pressure in the Roosevelt half. Coach Ream, "Caden has demonstrated a maturity beyond his years that not many players have. He's always been very calm under pressure. He was absolutely up for this moment tonight." In front of Lane is the spearhead of the Roosevelt offense, junior forward Ephraim Lunganga. On the year, Lunganga has a team-leading 16 goals, including a beautiful play on the first half of this game where Lunganga sped ahead of the defense and converted on a one-on-one chance against the goalkeeper. His pace as a forward is noticeable from the first whistle, but he was completely unknown to the Iowa soccer community until this spring. Until this season, Lunganga has never played high school soccer, as he and his family came to the United States from Africa. At the moment, he and his siblings, two of which are also on the roster, are still picking up the English language, Ream said, yet he has become one of the state's premier talents in short order as one of Class 4A's leading goal scorers as he gets comfortable with Iowa soccer and the English language. Coach Ream said, "Now I think everyone's aware of him." There were times in the past when Ream said that coming in for training was tough as the team was losing games, losing some excitement. This team, however, has made each day thrilling as the Rough Riders looked poised to make noise in the postseason that gets underway next week with Substate. Ream said, "I cannot wait every single day to see these guys and to have interactions with these guys. I'm enjoying it so much. It feels like they're enjoying it. I think everyone just is enjoying the experience, and it makes a difference. Everybody's supportive of each other. We don't have any sort of cancerous pieces in the team here. Everyone's just enjoying the game."
Thank you. UNI hires Franklin as new director of athletics. Megan Franklin has been hired as Northern Iowa's new director of athletics, the university announced in a press release on Monday. Franklin and the university have agreed to a five-year contract that is pending approval by the Iowa Board of Regents. She will officially begin her tenure at UNI on Monday, May 13th, when fans and donors can meet her on the Panther Caravan beginning in Clear Lake. Franklin will also attend events in Waterloo Tuesday, Des Moines Wednesday, and Cedar Rapids Thursday that week, the release said. Since 2012, the Lincoln, Nebraska native worked as Drake University Senior Associate Athletics Director, Strategic Initiatives and External Operations and or Senior Woman Administrator. She also held the role of Interim Athletics Director at Drake in 2017, as well as previous positions at Virginia Tech and Nebraska. During her tenure at Drake, Franklin worked with community leaders in Catch Des Moines on plans to host NCAA men's basketball tournament contests in 2019 and 2023, according to the release. She also contributed to the initial concepts of an on-campus soccer stadium. "We are extremely pleased to welcome Megan to the University of Northern Iowa," University of Northern Iowa President Mark Nook said in the release. Megan has been a key contributor to the renaissance of Drake athletics in recent years. Her understanding of the NCAA Division I landscape and the Missouri Valley Conference will be immediately beneficial to Panther athletics. Her longstanding commitment to student athlete success stood out among a field of very strong candidates. Megan's vision of how UNI athletics can compete for championships while bolstering the profile of our entire university impressed me and the rest of our search committee. We are excited for our entire campus community to meet her, as well as our passionate Panther fans and alumni. I appreciate President Nook and Panthers everywhere for entrusting me with the responsibility of serving as UNI's Director of Athletics, Franklin said in a release. UNI's rich tradition of success in the athletics arena, in the classroom, and as a key community partner were appealing for me. The signature of partner Panther Athletics is the people from the winningest coaching cohort in the Missouri Valley Conference to administrative professional staff who have dedicated their professions to the betterment of UNI student athletes. As I visited campus and engaged with President Nook, his leadership team and coaches and staff, it simply confirmed many of the reasons that I have admired UNI from afar for many years. I am excited to get to Cedar Falls to build on the legacies in the athletics director chair of the individuals before me. Go Panthers! Franklin has extensive experience in the Missouri Valley Conference, handling sport administrator duties for 15 sports at Drake, including the consistently successful women's basketball program that claimed five conference titles and made 5 NCAA tournament appearances during her tenure, the release said. She also hired current Drake head football coach Todd Sepsis, who was the 2023 Pioneer Football League and AFCA FCS Regional Coach of the Year. Other notable head coaching hires at Drake by Franklin included volleyball head coach Darren McBroom, men's soccer head coach Pat Finn, women's golf head coach Steve Smith, and men's tennis head coach Brianna Addison, all of whom improved their programs greatly since coming aboard, according to the release. Franklin arrived at Drake following a 9-year stint working in Virginia Tech's athletics department. During her time there, she helped recovery and support efforts following the horrific shooting that claimed 32 lives on the Blacksburg campus in April 2007, according to the release. She also worked as the Director of Student Life within the athletics department to further the personal and academic development of all Virginia Tech student athletes. She began her professional career as an academic counselor in athletics at the University of Nebraska. Franklin earned her bachelor's degree in community health education at the University of Nebraska and later received a master's degree in educational administration, specializing in student affairs from Nebraska. She owns a PhD in educational leadership and policy studies from Virginia Tech.
And now for Dear Abby today. Husband tells his wife to find a friend with benefits. Dear Abby, I have been married for the last 25 years to a wonderful man, Frank. We are very happy in all areas except for intimacy. Frank has lost all interest in intimacy and sex. It began about 2 years ago, and I have tried everything to reignite the flame in our relationship. Frank's sex drive has disappeared. About a year ago, he told me I should find someone, a friend, with benefits to take care of my sexual needs. At the time, I said no, hoping he would be interested again. Now, after a year of waiting, I am seriously considering finding a friend. Do you know, or do you think I should follow through with it or keep waiting and hoping Frank will change? Have you any advice about how to restart the intimacy in our relationship? Exhausted in Virginia. Dear Exhausted, you and your husband need to have another serious talk about this. He should also talk to his doctor and ask for a referral to a urologist and an endocrinologist who may be able to help. The inability to achieve an erection occurs in some men around age 50 and even younger, which is why Viagra is such a popular drug. If your husband is willing to discuss this with a medical professional, it may be the solution to his and your problem. Dear Abby, I met a coworker about a year ago, and we started dating. He had been clean and sober from alcohol for more than 10 years. We got along well, but he is drinking again, and his behavior has changed. There are mood swings, bouts of jealousy, and finger pointing. When he drinks, it's unpleasant, and the smell seeping from his pores is nauseating. He finds almost any reason to have a drink. When I try to talk to him about it, he says he does nothing wrong, and he drinks because he wants to, or some other reason that makes no sense. I'm tired of the excuses. Then he begs for forgiveness or accuses me of not wanting him around. I have told him he needs to work on himself and get back into the program. He says all he can do is take one day at a time. He drinks and drives, which poses a danger to himself and others. He's jealous of my ex and my grown children. He plays the victim and he answers to questions. His answers to questions are, I don't remember, I didn't do anything, or I don't know what you're talking about. I'm at my wit's end, and I can't take anymore. Please help. Toxic relationship. Abby says, dear Toxic, draw the line. Remind your coworker that when you started dating him, he was on the wagon. Tell him that when he drinks, his personality changes, and you do not like the person he becomes. You need to educate yourself about alcoholism, and an effective way to do that would be to join Al-Anon and attend some meetings. If you really can't take anymore, stop dating him. And if it creates problems where you work, inform your boss or supervisor. I'm sure that because of the potential liability, your employer won't be thrilled about having a drunk for an employee. And that brings us to the end of the Des Moines Register for today, Wednesday, May 8th. I am Lisa Horsch, and my partner at the microphone has been Patty Daniels. Earlier, you heard from Barb DeHeck and Denny May. You can listen to IRIS programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Support for today's readings comes from the Des Moines Register, the Iowa Public Radio, Iowa PBS, and bensoundmusic.com. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.